From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're following a number of major news stories today, from the impeachment trial and new revelations from former National Security Advisor John Bolton, to the Iowa caucuses, which are a week from today, to the coronavirus outbreak.
And I'm in Southern California, where people are still in shock following the death of basketball great Kobe Bryant. We'll have more on that in a few moments.
But first, let's get to Washington, where there is word that more Republican senators may be changing their minds on whether to allow witnesses in the Senate impeachment trial after that report in the New York Times about the draft of former National Security Advisor John Bolton's new book. Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, the New York Times first reported John Bolton's claims last night. What does the Times say that the book reveals?
Well, the Times report says that John Bolton, according to the manuscript that they write about, claims that President Trump told him that he wanted to withhold military aid from Ukraine until officials agreed to politically charged investigations, including that of Joe Biden and his son.
And that directly contradicts what the president's defense team claimed on Saturday in their first day of legal arguments. Here's Mike Purpura talking about notes of a July 25th call between Trump and the Ukrainian President Zelensky.
The transcript shows that the president did not condition either security assistance or a meeting on anything. The paused security assistance funds aren't even mentioned on the call.
That's one of President Trump's lawyers. How is the White House responding today to these new revelations from Bolton's book?
Right. The president is firing back in a trio of tweets very early this morning. He said that he never said that the aid was tied to investigations, that he never told Bolton this, and that if Bolton is in fact saying this, that all he's doing is trying to sell a book. And so are several of his allies and aides are saying similar things. Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, just came out with a statement as well, saying that he never heard Bolton raise any concerns.
So that's the White House. What about moderate Republicans, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, who are sort of on the fence about this idea of maybe extending the trial and calling witnesses like Bolton? Has anything changed there?
Well, it has definitely generated some new conversations. Utah Senator Mitt Romney said it is increasingly likely that other Republicans will join in calling for Bolton to testify. Susan Collins of Maine also released a statement that said that she is part of ongoing conversations with new interests in bringing in new witnesses. But on the other hand, we've also heard from other Republicans, such as Senator Barrasso from Wyoming, saying Bolton is just trying to sell books. Senator Blunt of Missouri saying nothing has changed. So there's still other senators saying we need to hear what the White House lawyers have to say over the next 2 days.
And the rules would be that you'd need 51 senators to say yes to witnesses. And right now, that would mean that the Democrats would have to add 4 Republicans to all of the Democrats in order to get witnesses to testify in the trial. What about the president's defense? What other legal arguments is the president's team going to be presenting as they resume their defense in the Senate?
Right. I mean, this obviously is a key argument, but it's not the only one that they're making. They still have plenty of others to make, such as they will still continue to argue that the president did nothing wrong and that he had valid reasons for withholding the aid, including corruption and burden sharing. They will argue, and they have argued, that the money ultimately flowed, that it was released to the Ukraine, and that the Ukraine never knew that it was being withheld until a news report came out about it. And mostly they will argue that this is simply a political move to interfere with the 2020 election.
Franco, the president keeps tweeting that he wants people to read the transcripts. We should note that no transcript of that key July 25th call with the Ukrainian president has actually been released, only rough notes about what happened on the call, right?
That is correct. I will just add that it is understood to be the rough transcript is understood to be substantively correct. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who was critical of Trump's July phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky, he testified that while some words were missing, he didn't see anything nefarious or he didn't consider it a big deal.
Franco, just briefly, do you think there are going to be any more revelations in the next couple of days before the end of the week?
You know, every time I think that there couldn't be one, there is another. So, you know, I'm certainly going to be watching very closely for the next 2 days of what the White House team has to say.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
We're learning more about the helicopter crash that killed NBA basketball great Kobe Bryant and his 13-year-old daughter and seven others yesterday. The helicopter had received special clearance to fly in foggy weather, while other private helicopters and planes were grounded. Meanwhile, at the Staples Center, the home of the LA Lakers, fans like Bobby Jimenez and Jay Sanchez gathered all night and into the morning to honor him.
Yeah, it's terrible, man. I didn't even play basketball, man, until I saw him play. 96, bro. I was 10. I will never forget that game. He didn't just care about the game, bro. He cared about everything. He cared about raising up generations. He cared about inspiring his daughters. There was nobody like him.
It's crazy. Like, Lakers, it's a family. It's not just a team. It's not just a sport. And, you know, Lakers kept me off the streets as a kid. I'd run home to watch Kobe play instead of going out doing something I shouldn't. It's just hard to take in, honestly.
That sound was from KQED Saul Gonzalez. Of course, most of us knew about Bryant's legacy career, his legendary career on the basketball court. But he was also a philanthropist and was especially passionate about working with children. Joining us now is Ben Paul, president and CEO of After School All-Stars. He's here in Los Angeles. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Kobe Bryant's work with After School All-Stars. He was an ambassador with your organization, we're reading, for more than 12 years.
Correct. So After School All-Stars is one of the country's largest after-school provider for low-income students. We serve nearly 90,000 students across the country. And when Kobe first came to learn about our work, he immediately said, you know, what can I do?
You know, we've been hearing so many stories over the last 24 hours, including Kobe's work in the L.A. area. There was this very moving story about him meeting with children who were native Spanish speakers and speaking entirely in Spanish during his entire time with them. He has this reputation for really connecting with children. How did kids react to him?
It was pretty much always the same thing. We would bring Kobe to one of our schools, and these are all low-income schools in high-density urban areas. And the love and the passion for Kobe was just indescribable. I mean, you'd have thousands of kids screaming his name, cheering and clapping and laughing, and the whole neighborhood would find out pretty quickly that Kobe's at the local school, and people would descend from all over just to catch a glimpse. Kobe just wanted to connect with the kids. It was all about helping the next generation, in particular children living in circumstances of poverty. And he would come into their school gym and show them basketball drills and talk to them about teamwork and resilience and hard work. And he really left an impact on a whole generation of students. And he even had an exchange program where he would send students from Los Angeles to a week in China and then send their Chinese counterparts to Los Angeles, where his foundation would cover all the costs in order to give kids, you know, extraordinary international experiences, which has been what's made such an impact on his own life.
How did that idea come about, and why do you think it was so important for him to give those kids that opportunity to see the world in that way?
I think Kobe understood that there's a generation of children growing up in the United States that have very little, and he wanted to do his part in a way that was meaningful to him, and that was basketball and international travel and just opening your eyes to broader experiences.
You got to know him during this time on this professional level, and I'm sure in many ways on a personal level, just being able to shoot the breeze with him and talk about his passion for this program. But what is the one thing about him that you are always going to have in your heart?
I think his smile. He was so personable and made you feel immediately at ease. He had this unbelievable smile that I'll never forget.
You're going to talk with kids today, and you guys will probably be talking about Kobe. What are you planning to say to them?
Well, I think life sometimes ends abruptly, and that's a lesson to all of us to live every day to the fullest and take advantage of the time we have in order to make an impact in our own lives and in the lives of others. And the work that we do, we tell the kids it's all about giving back. And the interesting thing is Kobe can give back as an international celebrity, but the students we serve who are living in poverty are all focused on giving back as well, even with their limited circumstances. And I think that that's a lesson that we can all take away from this.
Ben Paul, President and CEO of After School All-Stars. Ben, thank you so much for sharing your time with Kobe with us.
Thank you.
At least 81 people have died from a coronavirus outbreak that originated in the Chinese province of Hubei. All of those deaths have been in China, but on Sunday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed a fifth case of the disease in the United States. Chinese authorities are facing criticism for not containing the outbreak in time. Many remember how the government there covered up the extent of another epidemic, SARS, which caused at least 774 deaths worldwide in the early 2000s. Susan Jakes covered the story for Time magazine at the time. She's now editor of China File and senior fellow at Asia Society's Center on the U.S.-China Relations. She's in Hong Kong and joins us on Skype. And Susan, what is the mood there like in Hong Kong right now?
In Hong Kong, I would say people are starting to be fairly alarmed. When you go out on the streets in Hong Kong, everybody is wearing a face mask. Schools have been canceled in Hong Kong for the next couple of weeks, extending the Lunar New Year holiday. And people are pretty downbeat, although there have only been a handful of cases of people infected with the virus here in Hong Kong.
We're also hearing that protests are still continuing in the streets of Hong Kong, maybe not as many people as there were in the past, but people still out.
That's right. There have been continuing protests.
I want to ask you about SARS. We remember the outbreak of SARS in the early 2000s. It was a coronavirus as well. How similar is today's disease as far as we know?
There's a lot that we don't yet know about this virus. I think structurally, they are both in this family of viruses called coronaviruses, which also include, you know, versions of the common cold. And I guess the viruses are genetically similar. But beyond that, there's just so much that we don't know yet. We don't yet know the origin of the virus. There's suspicion that it may have come from animals in a live animal wet market, but that hasn't been established yet. So we don't know that much about how similar it is in terms of its infectiousness or its fatality rates. So the fatality rate for SARS was about 10%. You know, we're just beginning to have
Exactly.
And we probably won't have a real sense for quite a while because, the hospitals in Wuhan, which is the epicenter of the outbreak, are just now beginning to get adequate supplies of diagnostic kits. It sounds like some people are asymptomatic and they can still be infected with it and spread it to other people. And there's also not yet a consensus about how long the incubation period is for the virus.
In 2003, you broke the story of how the Chinese government was suppressing information about the outbreak of SARS. Has China been handling communication this time around differently?
Yes. I think that there have been some improvements. There's definitely been swifter communication with the World Health Organization. And yet, there are some troubling parallels. You know, during SARS, the beginning of the outbreak was in November of 2002 in southern China, and the disease then spread pretty rapidly through southern China and into Hong Kong. And there were, by mid-spring, about 3,000 cases, and there had been about 300 people that died. But the line from the central government in Beijing was that there were only a handful, about a dozen cases in Beijing, and that there had been no local transmission, that people, mm-hmm. that all the people that were sick in Beijing had come there sick from other places. And that turned out to be not at all true. And we learned from a whistleblower who was a very high-ranking, very senior military surgeon that at the same time as China's health minister was on television saying that there were only a dozen cases and there had been no local transmission, in fact, at one hospital alone, there were 60 cases mm-hmm. of whom most were medical workers who mm-hmm. had been infected by the patients that they were treating.
It makes me wonder, I mean, do the Chinese people trust what they're hearing from the government then about this coronavirus?
I think there is a lot of skepticism. And the complicated part about this outbreak is that it also, the people who are the public health officials and the doctors who are attempting to respond to this crisis are also dealing with imperfect information. Mm-hmm. So many people suspect that the number of cases is much higher than what's being reported, but whether that's a matter of concealing cases or not having the means to diagnose all of the cases or some combination of the two, we don't quite know. What does seem to be clear is that there was human-to-human transmission taking place earlier this month, and that wasn't reported to the public or even necessarily to the central government in a timely manner. And just today, the mayor of Wuhan sort of apologized for that and basically said it's difficult to report bad information up the chain of command.
Mm-hmm. I also want to ask you one last question. In the U.S., we're, of course, focused on the cases that have been confirmed here. But do you have a sense of how people closer to the source are feeling? I'm thinking about China's neighbors or other parts of East and Southeast Asia.
I think that there is concern. I mean, just in Hong Kong, which, of course, is part of China, but is also somewhat separate from the mainland, I think there's a lot of concern about people traveling from the areas where there's the greatest number of people are infected. And here there has been some pressure on the local government to close the border. And actually, the decision was made today to bar people from Hubei province, which is the province where Wuhan is, from coming into Hong Kong. So I suspect that we may see more of that kind of thing in the coming days, because there are just so many people on the move in Asia.
Right. That's Susan Jakes, editor of China File and senior fellow at Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations. Susan, thank you for this update.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, here in the United States, of those five confirmed coronavirus cases, two of them are in California, in Orange and Los Angeles counties. In Southern California, health providers are now stepping up precautions. And as festivities for the Lunar New Year kicked off over the weekend, the deadly virus was on the minds of many. Robert Garova of member station KPCC reports.
Soon after the first case of new coronavirus was confirmed in L.A. County, health officials held a press conference to let people know they were on top of the quickly developing situation. L.A. County Department of Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer said the case poses no immediate threat to the general public and that additional help was on the way.
CDC will be sending a small team to join us in preventing the spread of the virus.
At Monterey Park Hospital, about 10 miles outside downtown L.A., healthcare workers said they were getting questions about the virus. The hospital serves an area with a large Chinese community. Infection preventionist Christina Marco said they were following instructions from the CDC, and they're making sure to ask screening questions about travel, flagging anyone who's recently been to Wuhan City, where the outbreak is centered.
Our staff has been alerted to look particularly for this region of China as an area of high alert.
One doctor I spoke with said the fact that the virus was spreading during flu season wasn't making things any easier for providers as they try to differentiate between people infected with influenza and those who are at high risk for the Wuhan coronavirus. In Los Angeles' large Asian American community, news of the spreading virus was front page of Chinese language newspapers and on the airwaves.
Our whole stations We are covering this closely. We're following minute by minute, hour by hour, the updates. But at the same time, we're also responsible for not causing any panic.
That's Felix Guo. For the past 25 years, he's co-hosted a morning talk show called Today's Topic on KAZN Radio, a 24-hour Mandarin language station that broadcasts in the LA area. Guo's company is sponsoring the city of Alhambra's upcoming Lunar New Year festival. He says so far organizers haven't seen any signs of decreased interest, and all of the vendors are still participating. The performers are local, so they didn't have any issues with travelers either. Guo says his listeners don't seem to be too worried about the outbreak.
I guess maybe one of the reasons is the sense of distance, that they see this as something that's happening far away.
That may change as word spreads about the confirmed cases of coronavirus in California. At a Taoist temple in the heart of LA's Chinatown, hundreds of people came out over the weekend to celebrate the Lunar New Year. The place of worship was bustling Saturday as celebrants burned incense and took photos under a sea of bright red and gold decorations. But for some, there was a cloud of sadness hanging over the holiday. Temple-goer Carrie Nye said her heart went out to the millions of people in China who've had their holiday stifled because of quarantine measures there.
It's just a fortunate thing right now because, you know, right now with the new year and people getting together and this outbreak, you know, happened, and it's supposed to bring people together, but now everybody's hiding.
I asked Nye if she was worried about the new coronavirus here in L.A.
Well, of course we're concerned. Coming out on a day like this, like, you know, my friend goes, did you bring a mask?
She decided not to bring a mask, and fears surrounding the spreading virus weren't enough to keep Nye and her family from coming out to celebrate. For Here and Now, I'm Robert Garova.
The night before his first scene with Catherine O'Hara, Dan Levy was a little freaked out.
This is my first time acting since a Lifetime movie that I did with Misha Barton.
The stories behind the celebrities. Every Tuesday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
There was another mortar attack on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, Iraq, last night. Mortar or small rocket fire is fairly common near the embassy, but at least one of the mortars actually hit the embassy compound. There were no serious injuries reported. Let's bring in Jane Raff, NPR international correspondent, who is in Baghdad. Jane, what do we know about this attack?
Well, I actually heard the explosions last night and then the siren, the air raid siren from the embassy warning people to take cover. And then we learned that these were actually rockets. And as you mentioned, a lot of them are targeted at the green zone. This particular barrage, though, some of those rockets landed inside the embassy compound. Iraqi officials say that they landed near a dining facility and a gym, damaging those facilities. But only one person is believed to have been injured and not seriously injured in this.
Now, the State Department refrained from directly blaming Iran for the attack. What do we know at this point about the source? Who fired these rockets?
So we know who is saying that they didn't fire the rockets, and that's a long list of Iran-backed militias who normally are proud to take responsibility for these sort of attacks. All of this is because it's already very tense, and some of these militias don't want to make it more tense at this moment. There's sort of a moratorium, a stated moratorium on attacks on U.S. interests, because one of the leading Shia clerics aligned with these militias has said that they're going to hold off for now while U.S. troops are in the process of being told to leave Iraq. So there were statements from almost every Iran-backed group saying it wasn't us this time.
Now, one of the reasons this is such a big deal right now is that when there was an attack on an Iraqi military base where U.S. troops were stationed, an American defense contractor was killed. And in response, the U.S. assassinated the top Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. Is there any indication of what the U.S. response to this attack might be if they figure out who did it?
Well, if the U.S. really thought that Iran was behind this attack, and it really is quite a blatant attack, because although there are regular rocket and mortar attacks in the Green Zone, they generally, sadly, kill Iraqis. So if the U.S. really determined that this was an Iran-backed militia operating in Iraq, there could be serious retaliation. The thing is, almost every armed group here has mortars. And since it's a mortar rather than rocket attack particularly, that actually widens the list of possible suspects. But if indeed it were proved to be tied back to Iran, there would be expected to be serious repercussions here. And that's one thing that all officials are afraid of, that this could even escalate more.
And Jane, just briefly, what does this mean for U.S. troops in Iraq? The Iraqis have already said they want U.S. troops out.
Yeah, so the Iraqi parliament voted for them to leave. The Iraqi prime minister says he's actually working on that process. But when we dig down to it, there's actually no indication he is working on the process. So basically what that says is that a lot of these parties and the government want to say that they're telling U.S. troops to leave. But in fact, it's a huge debate here, and not everyone wants them to. Not every political party wants them to. The prime minister is a caretaker prime minister, and there are ongoing protests. There are so many things going on here. There isn't really a proper government in charge. Right. So that decision will likely have to wait.
Said NPR's Jane Arraf in Baghdad. According to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Americans owed about $1.5 trillion on their student loans as of last summer. That is a dramatic increase from a decade earlier. And taking on too much student debt is just one of the common money mistakes our next guest notices. Jill Schlesinger is a certified financial planner. Her book is The Dumb Things Smart People Do With Their Money, 13 Ways to Right Your Financial Wrongs. It's out in paperback next month. She's also a CBS News business analyst and joins us now. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So we talked with you last year about some of the dumb things that people do with their money, and people can find those at hereandnow.org. But you say there's more. And one of the things that you bring up is that people take on too much college debt. What do you mean by that?
You know, when the book was published, it happened before the whole college admission scandal. Mm-hmm. And so when that happened, I remember having so many conversations with people because they kind of figured out that this was one of my things in my book and they wanted to talk about it. And I said, isn't this just the greatest example of this? You have some privileged people who were spending gobs and gobs of money, not to mention breaking the law. And I always wondered, for what? And part of the reason I think that people take on too much college debt is that we're not really thinking through, like, what are we getting for all that debt? Mm-hmm. Yes, we know that people make more money with a college degree. And we also know that if you are a lower income household and your kid goes to a really good school, you're probably going to get that for free. And so what we find is that there's actually this weird middle ground of people who make too much money to qualify for really good financial aid. And they don't make enough money to be able to pay for college handily. And these people are the ones who are taking on so much debt. And I think that debt has really started to sink many young people's financial fortunes at far too early an age.
Okay, but there are probably very few people out there in the middle class in this country who aren't taking on at least some debt in order to go to college. How do you know how much is too much college debt?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, because we know that, you know, about three-quarters of kids who are graduating are carrying some debt. And certainly having $10,000 or $15,000 or even $20,000 is fine. I think a pretty good general, and I'm going to say like very general rule of thumb, is that you probably should not take on more debt than you're likely to make in your first year or two in the workforce. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to be a software engineer and you're going to be in a great company paying you $75,000 or $80,000, you know, maybe $60,000 of student loans is completely doable. But if you are going to be someone who maybe takes a different path, maybe you're going to be in a lower paying field, you probably don't want to take on that much debt. You want to try to figure out, how am I going to maybe take on whatever my first year salary is? Maybe that's $40,000 or $50,000. And I think one of the most pernicious types of debt that people are taking is graduate school debt, because in many cases, the graduate school degree does not see a huge bump up in salary in many fields. So you get a credential that doesn't pay off in the long run.
Okay, another dumb thing that people do with your money that we didn't have time for last year, but we do now, is people who are trying to buy a home when they should in fact be renting. What's the mistake?
Well, I mean, if you look at where prices are in many markets, there is a great opportunity for someone to say, well, you know, I can buy a home and it's affordable and it's a much better deal for me to buy that home rather than rent. But I think the rush to own something has really caused some people to perhaps get in over their heads. And we're talking about some of these coastal markets that have boomed in value. And, you know, you start to meet people who are saying, I am not putting money in my retirement account because I need to save for a home. And then you say, well, what about renting? And they say, well, I don't think I'm supposed to be renting. Renting is a fabulous option for lots of people. Number one, you are not burdened by upkeep. Number two, you have flexibility if you get a job offer someplace else. And for older people, you know, when my father died and a builder knocked on the door of my mom's house and said, I want to buy your house, she at first was saying, well, why would I do that? I need a place to live. And my sister and I kind of convinced her that renting would be a great way to free up the equity in her home and also see where she wanted to go next. So I think that especially now that the tax law has changed in some of these high tax states where you're not getting that full write-off, you really must look hard, run the numbers to determine whether renting or buying is best for you. Try to drown out that noise from maybe your parents or your grandparents who are saying, you're throwing money out the window. Instead of saying, I'm throwing money out the window, say, I'm buying flexibility.
Well,
thanks
is there
very much.
A calculation that you can do to figure that out?
There is. I mean, there are plenty of calculators online. The New York Times has a wonderful rent versus buy calculator that I've directed people towards often. I think that what you probably don't understand when you're in the process of crunching the numbers is that owning a home is not just the principal and the interest and the taxes and the homeowner's insurance, it's upkeep. So ask any homeowner, how much do you spend on the upkeep of your home every year? It's anywhere between 1% and 3% of the purchase price over the course of the life every single year. Mm-hmm. You add that up, that's a lot of money and can buy you a lot of rent.
Okay, one more that we have time for, another mistake you say that people make is that they don't have a will. And this is something that, you know, nobody really wants to face the idea that they're going to die at some point, but you've brought it up before. It's worth thinking about and at least putting some things in writing.
I would say that of all the dumb things in the book, and 13 of them, that this one, I believe, is the absolute worst mistake that people make. First of all, just because you don't want to talk about or think about your own death doesn't mean it's not going to happen, right? It's going to happen. And by not planning around this and not putting documents in place, you are robbing your heirs of their ability to grieve for you. Instead, they're going to be sitting around saying, Jeremy, nice guy, but so irresponsible. I wish he had done. No, they're not going to say that about you. But what happens is you throw a lot of people's lives into chaos. And I know there are some folks out there who are saying, I don't have any money. I don't need a will. You may not be doing this just because of money. Maybe there are guardianship issues. I presume that many people who have children think one of their siblings or one of their in-laws or someone in their family is better capable of taking care of their kids than someone else. Maybe it is about your own health care. None of us knows when the next moment we step off a curb and get into a car accident and find ourselves in a terrible situation. You want to assign somebody the right to make a health care decision on your behalf. Now, there are plenty of online will makers. That's fine. Generally speaking, I would much prefer people going to qualified estate attorneys. Just know that not doing this is not going to make it go away. Make your wishes known.
Jill, I said that was going to be the last one, but I want to ask you about one more thing, especially as we're sitting here with the stock market at all-time highs. You always bring up the fact that people should not think that they can time the markets and figure out when it's time to buy and when it's time to sell.
If I knew the answer to that, and if anybody knew the answer to that, they would not be telling you or me. So what I want to do is take everyone off the hook. You don't have to know the right time. What you need to do right now, as the market's at all-time highs, is say, hey, have I rebalanced my account? Do I have that set automatically through my retirement account or some other method? If I need money within the next year, should I take that money out of my account right now so it's no longer at risk? This could happen with maybe a tuition bill coming up, or maybe you do have a home down payment. But by and large, over the life of your investing, you don't even have to worry about the top or the bottom. You have to keep saving, keep investing in a diversified portfolio, rebalance once, twice, maybe four times a year. But, you know, don't worry. There's no wizard behind the curtain. It's just you, and it's the same for all of us. We just put our money away, and we'll reach our goals without too much muss or fuss.
Jill, I know that you just met Oprah recently. Did you give her any financial advice?
Yes. I think I refrain from giving financial advice to billionaires. But one, I will tell you one thing that is actually very humorous about that. I've often found that anytime I meet somebody and they know that I used to be in the business of giving financial advice or that I'm still a certified financial planner, they'll always ask me an offhanded, oh, by the way, I want to ask you a question. And it'll inevitably be about one of two things, estate planning and insurance, two things that are very hard to conquer.
Did Oprah do that to you?
I cannot reveal that.
Okay. Jill Schlesinger, a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money and author of The Dumb Things Smart People Do with Their Money. And you can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Jill, thanks as always.
Thank you.
For the fourth time in three decades, Haiti is under one-man rule. President Jovenel Moise gained more power earlier this month when the country's parliament dissolved as a result of failed elections that were scheduled for last October. All members of the lower chamber and two-thirds of the Senate are now gone. And now the U.S. is urging Haiti to set a date for an election. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in an exclusive interview with the Miami Herald.
We think the Haitian government has the capacity and the capability and the lawful right to do that. We need to have the elections. That is important. Once those elections will be held, there'll be a duly elected government. We won't have to be concerned about ruling by decree.
To talk more about all of this, we have with us Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jacqueline, first of all, why didn't the legislative and local elections happen in Haiti last October?
Well, last October, Haiti was in the midst of a political and economic crisis. Schools were shuttered for months. People could not get out of their homes. They could not go to work. Parts of the country were cut off from each other, even within the capital of Port-au-Prince, because opposition leaders and human rights activists, anti-corruption activists, all were demanding the resignation of President Jovenel Moise. We currently do not have the protest. Life has returned back to normal somewhat. But as a result of all that happened last year, Haiti was not able to hold any elections. And so as of the second Monday in January, which happened to be one day after the 10th anniversary of the commemoration for the 2010 earthquake, Parliament became dysfunctional and the president started one-man rule.
I want to ask you more about that earthquake and also these accusations of corruption. The president has expressed a desire to reform Haiti's constitution. What's the motive behind that?
Well, he says that the current constitution makes it difficult to govern the country. And there is a general consensus that there are problems with the constitution. The problem is that the constitution itself outlines how it can be modified. And that window closed in late September of last year because there were measures that he needed to take and also the lower chamber of parliament, as well as the Senate, needed to take. But, you know, the concern right now is given that President Jovenel suffers from credibility issues, can trying to modify this constitution or redo the constitution, can that plunge it even deeper into this protracted political crisis?
We mentioned that the U.S. is urging Haiti to schedule elections to restore its parliament. How influential is the U.S. In making this potentially happen?
Well, the U.S. is very influential. I mean, you ask Haitians in Haiti, they will tell you that President Jovenel Moise remains in power, although weakened because of the United States support. But saying Haiti needs to have elections and actually having those elections happen, there's a huge difference. I mean, right now, this country is undergoing a huge security issue. You have parliamentarians who have fled downtown Port-au-Prince. Last year, during the protests, the court system was completely shut down because of barricades. Today, the court system is shut down because of gang fighting. So how do you have an election in this environment? That is what Haitians are asking. And some Haitians are saying, you know what, at the end of the day, the country needs to have some sort of transition. But again, they don't want the president ruling by decree, ruling by executive order. So it's very complex, because the next question we have to ask is whether Haiti is in any condition to hold any sort of vote. There are issues in terms of the electoral process, but you know that an election has to happen. It's just a question of when and how, and it also has to find the money. I mean, this whole process last year, it started because of a fuel crisis where the government could not afford its fuel bill. So if you can't afford your fuel bill, how are you going to be able to afford the money in order to stage a nationwide election to re-elect 119 members of your lower house and to re-elect 19 members of the Senate?
You mentioned earlier that catastrophic earthquake that hit Haiti in 2010. We're now in an anniversary. Soon after the disaster, several countries and organizations made massive financial commitments to help rebuild. Are you seeing any of the results of those efforts evident today?
And that is a problem. So $13 billion was promised by international donors to help rebuild Haiti. And more so than, you know, what did the money buy? I think what you see in Haiti is a lot of evidence of things that did not happen. Yes, we have over 30 churches that have been built, but the major structure, the cathedral, still has not been built. It's iconic. The main public hospital, which was promised by France and the United States immediately after the earthquake, right now it's caught up in a $27 billion shortfall. There's the contractors stopped working on the site. What you see more are the failures of the promise of the international community as opposed to the proof, the delivery of those promises.
Jacqueline Charles is a reporter for the Miami Herald. Thank you for this update, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.